I'd like to begin with a little bit of a reason and maybe even apologetic, a case for why I think in church there's an appropriate place and time to begin to talk about sexual intimacy. If you've been with us in the sermon series, we've been talking about the Song of Songs. Maybe some of you have had a sermon on it before. Maybe some of you have had an entire sermon series on it before. But for the majority of us, we've never heard a sermon from this book, let alone an entire series dedicated to its topic. And its topic is important. It's about marriage, which perhaps many of us have experienced or are in the situation now or aspire to be one day or were in. And it's a topic that I think there's a lot of different opinions and indeed maybe even some confusion about today, about the value and the purpose and the institution of marriage. And while we're not here to get into a culture war, we're going to talk about not just marriage in general, but particularly the intimacy in the marriage, the full intimacy between the husband and wife, which includes the physical intimacy and the sexual intimacy of the husband and wife. I told the story before, but I think it bears illustration here. A few years back, my family with some other families from BCC, our church, went to the State Fair in New Hampshire. And as we looked at the petting zoo and the animals, we looked at the tractor pulls, we eventually found our way to one of those stands and the tables there. And upon these tables were a wide assortment of knives and weapons. Now, I grew up in L.A., and in L.A., everyone carries a knife. And so when I went up to the table, I proceeded to... I'm just kidding about that. We carry guns. No. And we went up to the table, and we noticed, looked at the... Because I have three boys, and one of my older boys at the time was old enough to be fascinated with weapons and knives, partly because they're guys and boys, and maybe because it's like sort of forbidden and stuff. And the thing you can't bring to school, you always want to look at. So I remember looking at a knife and saying, this is a buck knife. This is a... an assisted opening knife, if you know what that means. And then I said, this is a butterfly knife, which is a knife that has a casing. And I took it up and I showed my son, okay, this, you have to be careful with it. You have to respect this. And I proceeded to flip open the butterfly knife in a series of swift motions, to which the person watching me working the stand jumped back and say, do you know Kung Fu? And, okay, you might think that's stereotypical, but the point thing is, you know, I was trying to tell my son, this is important to understand. If someone ever is going to try to demystify the attraction of like a weapon, let it be your parents, let it be your father. I'm going to tell you what this is. I'm going to show you what it is so that actually you're not enamored by it when your friend inevitably someone brings it to school. You're inevitably at someone's house for sleepover and they say, dude, check out my dad's knife in his drawer. He doesn't know I know where it is. Or whatever it is. We want to imprint upon our children and be the first to frame the conversation of these important topics, because I promise you, I've thought even down to the youngest in this room who are worshiping with us, the middle schoolers, 8th, 7th, even 6th graders. Now, maybe some of you 6th or 7th graders, maybe this is all new. Maybe your parents and you haven't gotten to that topic yet. Maybe you don't know anyone at school that says anything. When I'm with parents waiting for their kids to get picked up at school events, they're very free with their language, with their choice of words, with their attitudes, with their complaints. And while we may hold it back a little bit when the kids come out of the classroom into the playground, I would imagine that in the privacy of people's homes, parents and adults talk their normal language, choice of words, and topics. And so as we come to this topic of physical intimacy in the marriage, I guess what I'd like to attempt this morning is that if someone asks you, what was the first time you ever heard discussion about the physical erotic nature of marriage and sexual intimacy? I think it might be valuable if you say, I heard it at church. Oh, you mean like at a retreat when the counselor was out of the room doing cabin check and you and your cabin mates were talking and stuff like that? You got a girly magazine? No, the pastor preached on it. And he tried to explain to us God's view of this topic. That would be the hope. Now, whether it's successful or not, it's for the Lord, and perhaps maybe to the degree that you are in your life and listening and eager to hear that. And so the topic, though, of this section of the song, this poem that has a unity but is not a historical account, I believe, but clearly has a progression, starting with their attraction before they get married, their wedding day, wedding night, their symbolic first conflict, until now. The last passage is actually going to be about their death and their ending, but this passage here is between their wedding day and night and conflict, their first sort of symbolic fight in their marriage, as well as the end of their marriage upon death when they die. So this is a section about what I like to think about those intervening, deepening years in the marriage journey. You've had your wedding and wedding night. You've also had your first good fight. How does the Song of Songs talk about marriage developing, deepening in their intervening years between those milestones of wedding, wedding night, first conflict and making up, and then till death do us part? And that's what this is about. In the context of that, we will address a little bit of the imagery about sexuality between a husband and wife. But really what I'd like you to think about this morning as we go to this passage is this. Three points I'd like to share for us. First of all, what is the husband's primary role or task, or what should the husband primarily do to deepen the marital intimacy over time? There's many things you could say about this, but in this song, in the context of the physical intimacy of a husband and wife, what can the husband do, distinctly the husband, to nurture and develop and promote a deepening marital intimacy over time? Are we doing it, husbands? If you're a guy, you want to get married, do you understand this? How well have you seen this modeled? What can the husband uniquely do to really contribute to deepening marital intimacy over time? Secondly, we're going to see how this poem, how this song, how the poet, perhaps probably Solomon, but not necessarily, it's not 100% clear who the author is, but it's definitely in the Bible. Secondly, we'll see, what can the woman do? What can the wife do? What is her unique contribution that would deepen marital intimacy over time? So number one, what can the husband do to nurture and deepen marital intimacy over time? And number two, to deepen marital intimacy, what can the wife do? And number three, how will it work? How will the husband and wife as a team work at this together? Very briefly. And then we'll take communion together as a church family. So first of all, what can the husband do to nurture and deepen marital intimacy over time? Now, before we get to this, I want to remind you that earlier in the Song of Songs, the Song of Solomon, the Canticle, these are all various names for this text, for this book of the Bible, this Old Testament book, the husband, the man, has already sung a song of praise about his wife. He's already talked about her beauty and her worth. And indeed, even in that section, in the earlier chapters, he actually began to talk about her sexuality and how lovely she is and how she likened him to a gazelle, a stag. And he likened her to this beautiful imagery. But they were stuck outside the gazelle, or the stag, the deer, the animal, the man was sort of pictured as outside. He couldn't get in. The woman was described as a dove nested in the crannies and cliffs of the rock, which is the inaccessible beauty before marriage. And we talked about how they had their wedding night and they had their, they consummated their relationship physically and sexually. And then it got very, very, you know, open there. And so here there's a song. Again, the husband, it's going to be similar imagery, but what I really want you to get, especially if you were here, is we want to see what is different about this song of praising his wife than the first time, so that we can begin to see the difference in this stage of their marriage. And if you don't know, if that's not quite clear, I hope it'll be clear as we go. So let's take a look at this passage now. In the context of the Song of Solomon, they have had their first major conflict, and it was over intimacy. He wanted to make love, and she didn't. But then she changed her mind. She was willing to make love, but he left. And then they made up. And so in that context, this is sort of what now he says in chapter 6, Verse 4, this is his words to his wife. You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my love, lovely as Jerusalem, awesome as an army with banners. Turn away your eyes from me, for they overwhelm me. Your hair is like a flock of goats leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes that have come up from the washing. All of them bear twins. Not one of them has lost its young. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. And let's pause there. So remember, he's comparing her now. You're as lovely as these two glorious cities, Jerusalem and Tirzah. And you're awesome. Now that we've had a fight, interestingly, he begins to compliment her with military beauty and imagery. Man, my wife, she's like a 4-star, you know, like, she's like a battleship carrier. She's like aircraft carrier, battleship. She's like a flight, you know, she's impressive. And when he says scary or fearful, he is complimenting her and praising her strength, as they've now had a little bit of conflict. But he's complimenting her and praising her. And then we get to the imagery he's said before, beginning with her body, hair moving on down to the cheeks. We talked about the eyes beginning there, and then the hair like a flock of goats, which we saw in earlier, like as goats stream down the mountain, they almost like it's almost like water pouring down the verdant green countryside. And that's what he's saying. Your hair comes down, tumbles down around your face in a lovely way, leaping down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of ewes, sheep that have come up from the washing. They're white, which is impressive in any day and age, but particularly back then. All of them bear twins, which means you got a full set, baby. It's a great smile, okay? Not one of them has lost its young. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil, invoking the imagery probably of the wedding night, the wedding veil. Then in the first song, in the first poem earlier in chapter 2, he began to talk about your neck, your body, even your breasts. But where does he go here? He has had sex with her, but this is where he goes. Verse 8. There are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. My dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, pure to her who bore her. The young women saw her and called her blessed, the queens and concubines also, and they praised her. He, instead of going to her physical beauty and her physical attractiveness and her sexuality, he stresses, after this fight, her uniqueness. He stresses her uniqueness and her beauty and her importance to him. And there's a lot of poetry going on here. He picks the most fabulously high-class women of the day. He starts with queens, the actual proper wives of royalty, people who bear heirs. They're the sons of queens would be the actual princes and new kings and rulers of the day. Then you have the royal concubines, the sort of the secondary tier wives. And then she just says, of infinite number, when you can move 60 to 80 to infinity, it's basically sort of a poetic Jewish device of saying the innumerable. I mean, there's royalty. There's the next tier under royalty, royal concubines. And then there's all women. You are unique among all of them. And get this, he is so enamored with her that the poet uses this device. They're going to praise the woman. But from the mouth of who? From the mouth of the eligible unmarried virgins of the city of Jerusalem. He is so enamored with her, he says, the women love you. The women praise your beauty. And that's why it has this amazing line, beginning now in verse 10, where they describe the woman. Who is this who looks down like the, who looks down like the dawn, beautiful as the moon, bright as the sun, awesome as an army with banners. And I remember earlier in chapter 2, or actually chapter 1, the woman had described that she was sunburnt, that she was embarrassed, that she was uncomfortable and insecure about her beauty because of the sun. And he, in his amazing poetry and imagery and tenderness and respect, he actually turns that and says, no, darling, you're not sunburnt in my eyes. You are as beautiful as the sun. And so what do we take from here? What is the man's contribution to this? Here it is. To deepen marital intimacy over time, the husband should deepen his admiration and affirmation of his wife. That as the days turn to weeks, to months, to years, the husband should be actively cultivating a deeper admiration of his wife and a deeper affirmation of his wife as the years go by. In the same way he works on his golf game, in the same way that he, you know, maybe tightens up this roster of his fantasy sports team, in the same way that he checks his stocks, in the same way that he maybe cares for his lawn or whatever pet project he has, an active pursuit of the husband can and should be to grow better, more skillful at affirming and reaffirming his wife, and admiring and growing in this deep respect for the woman that God has given him to marry, especially after a conflict. Now, we said he actually, the man's poem here, he talks about her beauty, but then doesn't go to sexuality, doesn't go to the body, goes to her uniqueness, her worth in his eyes. This is important for men to understand, for women. It's not just the sex. It's that you treat her with respect and the utmost tenderness that she deserves. And, but he invokes the veil. Now, that is confusing. He talks about the veil as if the wedding night, the last time she was under a veil, was basically, if you remember, the wedding night where presumably, according to the poem, all she was wearing was a veil. So he invokes the veil
bring it back to the wedding night and the sort of the sexual encounter of their first night together as a husband and wife. But he doesn't go there in terms of describing the beauty. What is this about? The scholars and commentators say it's this way. He's saying this, darling, I say darling because I never say the word darling, so you don't think it's me. If I say baby, I can't help but think of Karen. So darling, he says, I want you to know I admire you and I deepen my respect for you, just like the night we were married. But I don't want you to think that I'm saying this to get us back in bed. The man is specifically affirming her in a way that is not leading to a sexual encounter. Because he knows that if she thinks that's what he's all about, you're just saying this to get back on my good side so we can go back to bed. You're just saying this so we can get back to my good side so we can proceed with making love. And he's saying, no. After this conflict, my contribution, what I understand God is calling me to do, is to deepen my affirmation for you, is to remember how much you mean to me, how God has given me to you, and I want to do that in a way that goes us back to the very beginning. Nothing has changed except my admiration for you is deeper. And honey, know this. This is not at all with a hidden agenda so that we can make love again. Can husbands really compliment their wives for the goal of affirming them and respecting them and honoring them without any hint that, you know, this is to maybe score points so that later on we can be together and make love? That's what this song says a man can uniquely contribute. Because if he doesn't affirm her, women are smart. They will figure out or find a way to get that affirmation somewhere else. And that is how marriage begins to break down on the part of a wife. It's almost never physical, not least to begin with. It's always emotional. If a woman doesn't get the most admiration and affirmation from her home, from her husband, she will inevitably find it because someone else will notice. Someone else will give it to her. The home, the wife should think of the home as a place of the greatest admiration and respect. The husband's not perfect, obviously. The husband isn't Romeo. It's not like he's a Don Juan. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. He's not like this super romantic guy. But he must and should learn to affirm and appreciate her, especially after conflict. I remember the very first time that I can recall getting in trouble at school. It was kindergarten with my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Lowe. I remember distinctly her face. I remember distinctly where I was sitting in the group of people. We were sitting, listening to her. She was sitting on the piano bench facing us. The piano was behind her. And she said something. She was talking. And I did something wrong. And she called me out and says, Enoch, you're going to miss recess and milk time. You're going to stay in the class. And this is the first time. I remember that. And so I remember everyone went out to play. Everyone got their milk. Yeah, I didn't get my milk. They got their milk and they went out. And I had to sit there in that kindergarten room in Vista Grande. Oh, I shouldn't say that because now you know half of my security question answers. In that elementary school. And I remember distinctly, I was in trouble. Big trouble. What did you do, Enoch? Well, during her talking, I just kind of thought, what would a duck sound like in this room? So I went, argh. And she got upset, and that's how I got in trouble. Now that I confess my sin, we can move on. The point of this story is, after all the kids went to recess, as an adult now, I think I'm trying to appreciate and admire and see kind of her strategy and how she was disciplining me the first and only time she ever did that. She let me look outside, see the kids playing in the idyllic Southern California weather with their chocolate milk. And then near the halfway point of recess, where I'd had kind of like stewed and being kind of sad, she comes and sits down and says, do you know what you did wrong? I said, yeah, I quacked. And do you know why you shouldn't do that? Yeah, it's not respectful. I'm sorry. And she's like, okay, would you like your milk? I said, I would. Would you like to go play? Yes. And she says, okay, we're still friends, right? I said, oh, of course. She was saying that even though we had a fight, we're cool. Because I'll tell you what I would have done. If she didn't do that, I would have been scared of her for the rest of the year. I would have tried to, I would have avoided a one-on-one interaction with her. I would have felt like she didn't like me anymore. Because in my sort of kindergarten mind, if you get upset at me once, we're not good anymore. And frankly, as adults, don't we still fear that? At work, a customer, a client, a manager, we cross the line once. We have this insecurity that maybe they still don't like us. A teacher, a professor, a minister, a counselor, a friend, a student. And it's devastating when it happens in a wedding, in a marriage. And so he's saying, darling, honey, we had a fight. It was a fantastic fight. It was a terrible fight. And then we made up. And now I want you to know, I still admire you. Your hair is still like goats. Your eyes are still like doves, which were amazingly romantic compliments, you have to understand. And your teeth are still like sheep, okay? But now that I've known you more, and as we go through the years together, I want you to know, there is no woman on earth like you to me. And I want to grow in my affirmation of you and my respect of you, because that's what God calls me to do. That's what you deserve. And that is the husband's role, especially after a fight, especially after an emotional breakthrough, a breakdown, to come back and make up, not for the goal, men or husbands, of having sex, but for the goal of affirming that you are still that important to me. And of course, more could be said. The poem goes on much more. There's a lot more. And of course, there's a lot of other things that could be said about marriage in general. But I think given that this is a two-chapter section of the book, given that we are a mixed audience here, singles and marrieds and younger and older, and given all those things and time constraints, I think that would be the most helpful thing to draw out contextually from the passage for the man. The husband's role to deepen the marriage over time, to deepen marital intimacy, he should grow and deepen his admiration and affirmation of his wife. I still love you, I still value you, and this is not a hidden agenda just to have sex. So, if that's a primary and unique contribution of the husband to deepen marital intimacy, what about the wife? Now this, I admit, I'm a little uncomfortable with preaching this on several levels. One, I always get a little nervous not to tell the wives what the Bible says, because maybe I don't really understand, because I'm sure I don't. Secondly, this is the most erotic, maybe, portion of the book, indeed the whole Bible. Even this morning, I woke up and told Karen, baby, I've decided I have to read some of these parts. She's like, are you sure why? I said, because it's vital to the interpretation. It's crucial to the proper interpretation of the text, what I think we have to draw the application. And she looks at me, crucial to the interpretation of the text. So I said, yes. And so I just didn't even want my voice to have this on the internet saying these words, because someone's going to sample it and make a mean YouTube video of me somewhere. And now I've given you all these sorts of ideas. So maybe Andrew edit this out from that part of the audio. But I have to zero in. If the husband's way to deepen marital intimacy over time, primarily among many, many good ways, is to deepen, I mean, who talks about this, by the way? I mean, you know, you get better at your golf game, you buy a motorcycle, you do all sorts of things as a man, but do you grow in your admiration? This is what it's saying. Then what is the woman's responsibility or opportunity? And here is, let me say it to you, and let me find it in the passage. So first of all, let me point out, to deepen marital intimacy over time, the wife can grow in her responsiveness to the husband, in her responsiveness, in her tender responsiveness to her husband. The man has just said, you are unique, darling, among queens, among royalty, among celebrities, among all women, among all eligible women. You are the pure daughter of your mother. There's no one like you. You may have had sisters or siblings, but to me, you're the only one. And he then, after the section, gets caught up and begins describing her. Now, there could have been a point in this conversation, this sort of imagery, if you think, now he's getting a little specific and particular and sexual. So if you are a parent sitting with your child, and younger folks, when I say young people, I don't want to sound like those old people always send it to me, even though I know you think I'm old. But if your parents haven't talked about this, again, I hope you ask your parents, can we do a Bible study, Dad, Mom, on this, and talk about what this looks like? And Mom, Dad, how do you think about marriage? And do you disagree with everything Pastor Enoch said? So let's take a look. He is now really enamored with her, chapter 7. And he's going to get very specific. But he starts with her feet and moves up the body. Chapter 7, verse 1. How beautiful are her feet and sandals, O noble daughter. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Now, just keep in mind, these are all compliments. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bath Rabim. Your nose is like a tower of Lebanon, which looks toward Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. Verse 6. How beautiful and pleasant you are, O loved one with all your delights. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I say, I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its fruits. Oh, may your breasts be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. It goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Now, aside from the fact that some of us got really uncomfortable there, what is happening here? What is the thing that I think we should take away from this passage? The man and the woman, post-conflict, he's describing his deepening admiration for her, his respect for her, in a way that's not just intended to get her back into bed. And he's describing her beauty. And here is what the author particularly wants us to know, because they use a poetic device here, and it's a change of the voice. It's a change of the speaker. He is talking at the most erotic portion of the entire song. I won't say it again for you, but beginning in verse 7, he describes her stature and her body and what he wants to do with his, with that body, and describes verse 9, the mouth is like the best wine. It's basically they're very passionately kissing. And in the midst of this most erotic description, what happens? She picks up the poetry and finishes the poem for him. He's like, darling, you are so beautiful. I am so excited to be with you. You know, your mouth is like the best wine. And then she says, she sings. She picks it up and says, yeah, my mouth like the best wine. She says this, it goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. She responds and finishes his passionate love poem for her. And so this is why it's vital for me to have read some of the parts that were more, I think, still tasteful, a little bit more descriptive, because you need to see at the most erotic, passionate portion of this song that she takes over and completes his praise of her. She is responsive to him. And really, ladies, wives, I gotta tell you, a responsive wife arguably makes for a wonderful lover. In the privacy of a bedroom, when maybe the lights are out, the makeup's gone. It's not your clothing. What really makes a passionate physical intimacy lover for a wife, at least from this passage, is her responsiveness. When Karen and I first got married, or even I think we were courting or dating, but I definitely remember when we got married, you know, now that we're married, I can hold hands with her, right? Because it's before you're married, it's three Bible lengths apart. Now we're married, it's hold hands. And so we're holding hands. And the thing with Karen and holding hands in those days is, you have to understand, I got her permission to share this, sort of a smiling, shake your head, but not at the same time permission. I would hold her hand. Now, it's possible that I didn't get much physical affection from my parents or anyone. So I sort of appreciate the touch as my love language, if you kind of know those, that literature. I just really appreciate, I like to hug my kids. I gotta, you know, I like to mess up their hair. I like to hold my wife's hand. Now, Karen never really had this sort of same need. And on top of that, she's a woman in that sense. So maybe it's not the same meaning to her. So when I would hold her hand, she would like tolerate it and just let it stay there. And so one day I said, baby, you know, when I hold your hand, could you like move so that it feels like I'm not holding the hand of an unconscious person? And she's like, oh, why? I said, well, why? For me? And she goes, okay. So now, God bless her sweet soul. She's very responsive. You know, really, when we're holding hands, she gives me a squeeze once every 20 minutes or so to know she's alive. I have her permission. But I say that on a fairly rated G level illustration. But the key thing here is, whether it's a simple little bit display, a touch in the kitchen where you're washing the dishes, and, you know, as you walk by and that someone touches your shoulder, your spouse touches your shoulder or something like that. I'm not sure what wives think men want. I don't even know if I know what all men want, but I do know that this text is saying this. One thing that the man appreciates, the husband delights in, is a wife who will respond. Respond sexually, respond emotionally, respond tenderly, respond passionately. not that she has she doesn't have her own personality or preferences or desires. But again, this is why we got to talk about the man first, okay? She is responding to what? His sexual overture? No. If anything, this passage shows the nature of sex as a Christian vision. She responds with a physical bit of intimacy because he has initiated an emotional bit of tenderness. And this is sort of how it's supposed to work in its beauty. The husband affirms her, doesn't necessarily even say, I'm not saying these nice things to you, affirming your value and your worth and esteem in my eyes because I want to make love or have sex. But she, in her responsiveness, appreciates that and then responds emotionally, verbally, physically, and perhaps sexually. And that's what, again, there's so many more things we could say in this poem, even this one section, but just imagine, would that be enough of sort of a starting point for a newly married couple to deepen their marriage? That husband and wife, now they've been married a couple months, a year, a couple years, several years, 5 years, 20 years, that here's something that you should not get tired of nor complete. That husband, you over time grow better, grow more skillful, grow more delicate, grow more wiser, shrewder, more compassionate, and more tactful in your affirmation of her worth, of your admiration of all that she's done. In the years, you might see her care your children. You might see her sacrifice. You might see her tend for her aging parents. You might see her, you know, work hard. You might see her manage the household, certain aspects or chores or finances or tasks. You might see her battle disease. You might see her change and age physically. But in all those things, you as husbands should have more ammunition to load into your canon of amazing affirmation. To tell her, you know, I thought I was marrying a wonderful woman, but now that I've been married to you, I know you're very forgiving. Or, you know, I thought I married an amazing woman, but now that the Lord maybe has blessed you with a job or with children, I see you're so patient and giving. More time can give a husband more ammunition to tear her down. More time can give a husband more reasons to critique and to dismiss and to be abusive even to his wife. But the husband's primary role, which will never be exhausted, is to grow in his affirmation, admiration of all the things that God has given to him in this woman, who is not perfect, and yet is perfect for him in the vision and in the infinite mind of God for that part of their lives. And the woman, can she do this? Can she grow in this for the next 30, 40, 50 years to say, God, help me know how to be a responsive wife to his needs, to minister to him physically, because there's no one else on the planet that's supposed to minister to a husband in that intimate way. Can I grow in that? Can I be wiser in that? Can I be more skillful? Can I delight him in that? Can I make him feel how much I care about him? And can I do that because he's made me feel so admired and so affirmed and so appreciative? That is the interplay among many things about a husband and wife moving forward. And of course, hopefully there's many ways to apply this, but before we end this section and before we move to a time of celebrating and observing communion, the Lord's Supper, we get to the last part of this passage where I think we talk about how does this work. Let's take a look now beginning in verse 11 of chapter 7. Come, my beloved, let us go out into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened and the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes give forth fragrance, and beside our doors are all choice fruits, new as well as old, which I have laid up for you, O my beloved. What do you think the poem is saying is happening here? That's right. Chapter 8, verse 1. Then she writes something very strange to us. She says to her beloved husband, oh, that you were like a brother to me. Now, I just got to say, going to high school, there the F word, the really bad F word was when you asked a girl to, you know, to go out and she said, I think of you as a friend. Or you're like a brother to me. Oh, just kill me, why don't you? Right? A brother? So she's like, you're like a brother. What does she mean? Well, let's keep going. Chapter 8, verse 1. Oh, that you are like a brother to me, who nursed at my mother's breasts. If I found you outside, I would kiss you. What? And none would despise me. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to teach me. I would give you spiced wine to drink, the juice of my pomegranate. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me. Now, if you were here a couple weeks ago, we know that that position, left hand under head, right hand embracing, is the physical position of lovemaking. What's going on here? She is basically saying this. You know, in our culture, even a wife and a husband cannot hold hands or kiss in public in that ancient Jewish culture. It would have been seen as inappropriate. It would have been seen as quasi-sexual and rudely and vastly inappropriate. But in that culture, it was normal and natural for brothers to kiss each other, sisters to hold hands, and for a sister to kiss her brother and to do so. And she is not saying that their marriage is a secret or that there's some sort of twisted, incestuous thing going on. She's basically saying this: you know, you're my husband, but if you were my brother, I could hold your hand as we walk back from the market. You're my husband and I want to be with you, but if you're my brother, I could take you into the house lead you by hand into our home, and it would be appropriate. She was saying, I would love to be making love to you. And as she describes this, we have this verse that now would be, I believe, the third time, chapter 8, verse 4, where she gives a warning. But it's a different warning because she's married now. So what is this warning? She says, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Now, in the earlier chapters, before she was married, when she was beginning to fantasize about her husband and think, okay, no, don't awaken love. We're not married yet. It's not time. Now, when she says this, don't awaken love yet, she's basically saying, look, I, by the grace of God, waited and addressing, who's she addressing? The daughters of Jerusalem. She's addressing the women, the poetic chorus in the song. She's saying, ladies, unmarried women, don't stir up love before time because it was worth the wait. And even in marriage, that warning still holds true. Let me put it this way. How do you husbands and wives do this? It's like this. In marriage, when you have physical intimacy, you still need to wait. You still need to wait for the right moments. When she is properly encouraged and affirmed. When she knows that you've taken care of her. I mean, it's mostly in the conscience of the woman because the guy, biblically and practically, he's pretty much ready quite often. But the wife, she's saying, you know, there's still a waiting. I liken it this way. Whenever you have to carry a heavy object, especially when you're younger, I love moving out with people because we'll often, in the last couple years, a lot of people moved out, a lot of the youth workers move out. They invite the teens to come move stuff. You know, I don't know if you know that. And they'll invite the teens. And I remember moving someone out about a year and a half ago, and a different pastor from a different church, he invited a bunch of his teens. Now, when we were working and moving his stuff out, the teens took out things like bookshelves and stuff like that, and I took out things with the husband, like their bed and some of their furniture and other stuff. And I said, oh, do you want me to get that? No, the teens can do that. You want me to get that? No, the teens can do that. Oh, can the teens carry that? No. No, let's carry that. And I said, well, how do you decide which one gets carried by what? She's like, well, if we don't care about it, we let the teens carry it. Because they'll drop in. And here's what I've seen a lot of people do. Not to make fun of teens, but really to totally put you down. No, I'm just kidding. So, like, you know, when people are carrying something really heavy, they go, can I put it down? It's heavy. Can I put it down? Okay, no. Is it time? Okay, you can put it down. And then how does someone maybe less experienced put down this very heavy object? Oh, boom! All right, okay. Waiting for marriage for sex is dangerously like that for some people. Hold it. You can't wait. You can't put it down yet. No, you're not married. You're not married. Okay, you're married now? Okay, drop it. Punk. And just smashes and falls with great utter weight. Being married does not mean that you take less care and time in cultivating the physical aspect of a relationship. It's still there. You can't just drop it now that you're married. You have to lower it with the care it provides. And so she's saying, now that we're married, now that we had our wedding night, we had our fight, we've made up, and now we're trying to learn how to deepen our intimacy over the years, daughters of Jerusalem, unmarried people, know this. You still, in marriage, have to work at the timing, work at meeting the other's needs, work at being selfless instead of selfish, work at this intimacy. And as we consider this kind of work, this kind of responsiveness, we see that really God and his mercy, you can learn this from God. The idea that someone affirms you even though you've blown it, even though you've had a falling out, cannot help but be connected to what Christ does. And here's what sort of a growing mature Christian perspective is. A growing mature Christian somehow figures out that, yes, it was a sinful thing I did. I disobeyed God's word or somehow, but God still loves me. And how to do that without abusing the grace? Yeah, how to do that without feeling like it's based on my works or somehow earning God's favor is a challenging thing. But that's sort of what marriage is. Do I really look at my mate and say, you know, you've hurt me and I've hurt you, but we're going to still be faithful. How do we do that unless you know the God who is faithful to you? And that's what the Lord's Supper really is. Does Jesus still love us? Well, yeah, he died. Does he still love me? He rose for you. He shed his blood for you. And as we kind of go from here into this worship time of the Lord's Supper, especially in the concept of marriage, and I know that a lot of people in our marriages, we're struggling. So maybe this week a husband's going to take his wife's hand and say, darling, honey, I need to ask you to forgive me because I have not grown as I should in my affirmation and admiration of you. And maybe the wife takes the husband's hand this week and says, how responsive have I been? Is there something I can grow? Can God help me to love you more the way he wants me to? And if we're not married, how do we as a family nurture this? How do we praise this when we see it? How do we honor this the way Christ wants us to honor it? Let's bow our heads and pray and prepare our hearts for communion. And at this time, I invite those who are helping serve communion to meet at the table. Our Heavenly Father, as we come to the table, we ask that you would remind us of this table to point to the one day we will share a feast and a table with you when we're reunited in heaven and all your children are there. All those who have been humbled to the point of admitting our sin and our need for you and broken, but put together by your grace. So help us to receive this bread and this cup with the full sobriety because it cost the life of your son, but also with the great gratitude because it cost the life of your son and the great joy that comes with it. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. On the night Jesus was betrayed, he took bread and broke it and passed it around to his disciples, saying, this is my body, which is given for you. And after supper, he took the cup and said, this cup represents my blood, which is shed for you. Drink this in remembrance of me. And every time you eat the bread and drink the cup, you proclaim my death until I come again. The Lord's Supper is a time for us to honor that sacrifice and that communion of Christ.